From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Hillary Clinton finally does it again. Hello again, I'm Maureen Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. More than a minute into a two-minute web video with everyday Americans talking about their futures, Hillary Clinton says what everyone already knew.
I'm getting ready to do something, too. I'm running for president.
What everybody doesn't know is why she's running and what she stands for, beyond becoming the first woman to capture the White House. Now she is literally hitting the road to Iowa. No more helicopters or jet planes. Will her new style appeal to her party's liberal wing? Today's talking point, personal belief exemptions from childhood vaccinations are pitting individual rights against public health. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage on our mobile app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. Hillary Clinton's second announcement for president is a low-key contrast to what's described as her alpha male style the first time around. But she is still one of the world's most famous people, hoping to raise $1 billion between now and November of next year. We'll see how the campaign looks at the beginning. Today's talking point, despite the recent outbreak of measles at Disneyland, some Republicans agree with liberals in wealthy suburbs, personal belief exemptions to the vaccination of children should be allowed. Others insist public health is more important. First, this news update. In the midst of negotiations over Iran's nuclear program, Vladimir Putin has lifted a ban on the sale to Iran of sophisticated Russian air defense missiles. Andrew Weiss is vice president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he oversees research on Russia and Eurasia. Andrew Weiss, always good to have you on our program.
Thanks so much, Warren.
At the White House today, the spokesman, Josh Earnest, condemned this possible sale, saying the U.S. takes very seriously the safety and security of friends. What does that mean?
For quite some time, the United States has been pushing the Russians to make sure that these missiles don't go to Iran. And the main reason is the fear that they would help Iran defend nuclear sites against possible military strikes carried out either by the United States, Israel, or some of our allies in the region.
So the friends would be Israel or the allies?
Correct.
And how much of a risk is there, does it appear, of Iran attacking Israel or any of our other friends in the region?
I think it's an open question. The leadership of Iran has repeatedly used very provocative language to talk about the illegitimacy of the Jewish state, and the Israelis, I think, take very seriously any threats to their security. So, you know, part of this whole nuclear deal is intended to try to deal with the question of, is Iran seeking a nuclear weapons capability? And if so, how do you roll it back? And so how can you provide some form of stability in the Middle East, given the very serious issues that Iran's nuclear program has raised for the international community and for the region as a whole?
So what exactly is it then that Russia is doing or announcing that it's going to do that is so dangerous?
So back in 2007, I think the genesis of this deal is very important. The Russians announced that they were going to do this $800 million deal to sell a very advanced air defense system, which is known as the S-300, to Iran. And then one of the early achievements of President Obama's so-called reset policy with Moscow was Russia's support for a series of UN resolutions as worries about Iran's nuclear program intensified. So when one of those UN resolutions was adopted in 2010, the Russians basically undertook a commitment not to provide this advanced weapon to Iran. And that deal basically stayed in place from 2010 to 2015. Now the Russians are saying, well, things are changed now, and we're no longer feeling obligated under the UN resolution to keep this system away from Iran. And the Iranians actually took the Russians to court and have had them in international arbitration for the last several years, saying that the Russians had reneged and hadn't fulfilled the terms of their contract. So it's been a costly issue, I think, for Russia's reputation as a reliable arms supplier around the world, but it's also been an issue that's a real sticking point in Russia's relationship with Iran. And so the Russians see the world is starting to make nice with Iran, doesn't want to be left out of that effort.
So what about these defensive missiles? What does that actually mean? Does that mean that they can strike other missiles that would be incoming?
Yeah, this is a defensive system, the Russians like to point out, so it's not intended to be an offensive system, but rather it's something that would help Iran defend its territory against strikes of advanced missiles or advanced fighter aircraft, I'm sorry, military aircraft. So for the Russians, this they can continue to insist is not going to change the strategic balance in the Middle East, but I think for the Israelis and the United States, it very much looks that way.
Is this something that's liable to have an impact in Congress as it determines whether or not to approve the Iran deal, if in fact a deal is struck, if in fact Congress votes to give itself that right?
I think it certainly is very unhelpful, and the timing is not helpful. But you know, these issues about what the president's authority is to continue the negotiation with the Iranians and whether Congress should step in now and start to mouth off and say that Congress can't support it, those are, I think, bound up in some far more complicated questions than what is Russia doing or not doing. But it's certainly unhelpful, and I think the administration is going to try it as best it can to say, keep the focus on the deal and keep the focus on the negotiation and not try, you know, bring everything to a halt simply because Putin is trying to get in on the ground floor as the world community moves on some path toward reconciliation with Iran.
So $800 million sounds like a lot of money to the Russians, and their economy is not in great shape.
Exactly. And so if you look at overall Russian military sales around the world, that we're talking about $12 to $13 billion worth of business. That is incredibly important business to key parts of the Russian establishment. And it just so happens that those are people who are very close to Mr. Putin, and some of whom, including the head of their defense export industry, is one of the people who's been targeted by Western sanctions. So we're in this awkward position of having basically treated Russia like an outcast. And now the Russians are saying, well, you know, you want to treat us like an outcast, we're going to go our own way. So it's, you know, this is one of the unfortunate byproducts, I think, of the very sharp confrontation that's emerged between Russia and the West.
Very quickly, when might this sale take place? Is there any chance so far of stopping it?
We don't know. The Russians have leaked in the last couple hours the idea that the time frame for implementing the contract might be up to 1.5 years. But at this point, basically what Putin has done is he's authorized the Russian government to go ahead with the transfer. He didn't commit to a specific timeline.
Andrew Weiss with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. As always, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thanks so much, Warren. Great to be here.
In a moment, Hillary Clinton finally does it again on To the Point.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day, and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive Angel Clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. Hillary Clinton is off and running at last with a campaign announcement that's low-key compared to her launch in 2007. Here's part of yesterday's web video after we've heard from a cross-section of everyday Americans talking about the future.
Americans have fought their way back from tough economic times, but the deck is still stacked in favor of those at the top.
Now Clinton is on the road to Iowa in her Scooby-Doo van, a far cry from the helicopter that she used in 2007. Jonathan Allen is author of the book HRC, State Secrets and the Rebirth of Hillary Clinton. He's chief political correspondent for Vox. Hi, Jonathan. Good to have you back on our program.
Great to be on, Warren. Thank you.
That first line, Americans have fought, people at the top, that sounds a lot like Elizabeth Warren.
It sure does. And I think the interesting message here is that without distancing from Barack Obama, without suggesting that he's, failed with the economy, she's saying that the economy's gotten better, and yet the cards are stacked against everyday Americans, her term for regular folks. I think it shows how she's trying to calibrate a message that things have gotten better, but they still need to get better and more fair.
So she doesn't have to criticize Clinton at the same time she can concede that people are in trouble. Obama, at the same time she can concede that people are in trouble.
That's right, and I think she has to do that because I think a lot of families have not felt and individuals have not felt the improvement at the top of the economy, sort of the top-line numbers of the economy we've seen getting stronger and stronger for quite some time. But wages have lagged that, and certainly the wealthy have reinvigorated their pocketbooks a lot faster than regular folks have.
Now, you have been among those who have compared this year's announcement to what we saw in 2007, which you described as an alpha male style announcement. Tell us a little bit about how that differed from what we saw today and yesterday with this video coming out on the web and then the Scooby-Doo van heading across the country.
Well, I think there were a couple of key differences. The first thing that really jumps out, of course, is that in the 2007 video, Hillary Clinton says, "I'm in it to win." It's about her. It's about what she wants to do for other people, how she's going to propel them forward. This time around, there's 2 minutes of video of montage of other people talking about their hopes, their dreams, their aspirations, and even their fears, capped by Hillary Clinton at the very end saying, "I'm running for president, and I want to be a champion for all of you." A very different style, a message of it's not about me, it's about you. And I think that's what her campaign is going to try to capture. Now, whether she can sell that to voters a year and a half from now is another question. I think there are people who will see that as disingenuous. But I think it's hard to criticize this video, particularly in context of the one from 2007. This was a gigantic leap forward for her.
Let's hear a bit of the video from 2007.
So let's talk. Let's chat. Let's start a dialogue about your ideas and mine. Because the conversation in Washington has been just a little one-sided lately, don't you think? And we can all see how well that works. And while I can't visit everyone's living room, I can try. And with a little help from modern technology, I'll be holding live online video chats this week starting Monday. So let the conversation begin. I have a feeling it's going to be very interesting.
So why, Jonathan Allen, was that such a failure when, by comparison to this year's announcement, you think it'll be a success?
Well, I obviously can't project forward to the end of 2016 to say whether it will be a success more than it was as a successful messaging kickoff for her in line, I think, with what she and her advisors think is her best strategy, which is, again, to be a champion for others, to not... that first one was, in some ways, if you look at that video, and obviously can't do that on radio, but for those who have seen it before, it's strangely isolating of Hillary Clinton. It makes her seem by herself, sitting in a room by herself, looking into the camera. In this other video, you've got all these people talking, and it's moving, and it's, sort of fast, upbeat music in the background. And the other thing that I think is fascinating about this year's is there's all of those people in the video don't give testimonials to Hillary Clinton. Typically in campaign ads, what you'll see is, somebody getting off of work and saying, "I'm going to vote for so-and-so because, they're helping me with my job or whatever." None of that in this. It was intended to not be about politics, and while we all know it was about politics and it is about Hillary Clinton trying to be president of the United States, the tone of it was not that.
And the folks are all talking about what they're going to do in the future and how great everything is going to be, and they are a remarkable cross-section of gender and race and ethnicity, and you'd think you're looking at the Democratic Party.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's safe to say you would not see a Republican launch video that was quite the same. For instance, I doubt you would see a Republican launch video right now with a gay couple holding hands. So there are segments of the population that Hillary Clinton is reaching out to that her Republican opponent will probably end up using different means to try to reach out to. This was very overt.
Does it appear that this time around she is running much more as a woman than she was the last time around?
Oh, absolutely. I think even in the video you saw that, not so much explicitly, but implicitly, talking about family issues, talking about figuring out how to send kids to college, about going back to work, about retirement. A lot of these issues that are broader economic issues, particularly for families, are more appealing to women voters or more likely to be of concern to women voters. Even if you look at, obviously things like equal pay, and you look at child care and family and medical leave time, all those things affect family economies and certainly bring in some men voters and have, are of concern to men voters, but are of particular concern to women voters who are often considering those particular issues in their homes. So I think this video shows that she's trying to go in that direction. Even, you know, her own voice was a little softer in this one than the last time. So I think we will see a Hillary Clinton that is much more comfortable with running as a woman. Last time around, she, as one of her longtime advisors put it, she ran as the Queen Mary.
Jonathan Allen, again, at Vox, author of the book HRC, State Secrets and the Rebirth of Hillary Clinton. Don't go away. I'll come back to you in a moment. But first, I want to introduce Ed Kilgore. He is now managing editor at the Democratic Strategist. He is a principal blogger at Washington Monthly's political animal blog. At one time, he was policy director for the centrist Democratic Leadership Council, much associated with Bill Clinton. Ed Kilgore, it's good to have you as always.
Great to be here, Warren.
Nothing in this video about being a U.S. senator, being the Secretary of State, and all of her credentials. She may be the most credentialed candidate ever to run for President of the United States. Why do you suppose all that was left out?
Well, I think most people pretty much know that about her. They know her resume. They know her credentials. They're used to seeing her. They're not necessarily used to thinking about her relationship to the voters she claims to represent. I agree with everything Jonathan said about the tonalities of this ad. I think it's important that she indicated she was planning to earn people's votes, was not depending on them. And besides, she's got, Lord knows, she's got many, many, many months to fill out any holes in her resume or her agenda that people may be worried about. This is a launch video, not the whole campaign.
Well, now she is on the way in the Scooby-Doo van to Iowa for what are described as small meetings. Anybody who's ever covered a Democratic primary or a Republican primary, for that matter, in Iowa knows that they go door to door and they try to make it appear that this is a very personal thing. And then when you pull back with the camera lens, you see there's a crowd of television cameras and other reporters and people with microphones all trying to figure out what's going on. How is she going to conduct this low-key campaign, Ed Kilgore, in Iowa?
Well, I think it's important that she shows up in Iowa, in part because the national media have really been obsessing about complaints from Iowa Democrats, you know, that they want somebody other than Hillary. And I've written a lot about this. Frankly, what's going on is that Iowa Democratic activists want the money and attention associated with a competitive caucus. It's human nature. So I think she needed to go there, give them some love, give them some face time. And I think you'll see a much different reaction to her when she is in Iowa than you're getting, you know, before her announcement. So I think that's why she's there, and I think she's certainly experienced enough to handle the strange dynamics of Iowa. And I think her lead is such that she's not in any real danger of losing there.
Back to Jonathan Allen. How do you think she's going to pull this off, just from a practical standpoint, and look like she's exchanging love with the voters of Iowa and doing it with, 20 or 30 cameras focused on her at the same time?
I think her best, for most of us trying to have candid shots, her best strategy is to ignore the cameras as best she can, to emphasize that it's her time to talk with voters. I hate to say this being a reporter, but for the most part, she's better off ignoring us most of the time.
And she's good at that.
She's good at being angry at us or distancing herself from us, and I'm not sure that's the right strategy. I think ignoring is probably a better one. And then, of course, have your times to sit down with reporters. Have your times to sit down and talk to the public across the television waves or through social media. I mean, there are a lot of different ways to play it, and I think what we're seeing from her is that she wants to have a less adversarial relationship with the press. And frankly, having written a book on her in the last couple of years, my experience with her was very different, I think, than those who were on the 2008 campaign trail in terms of access and cooperation from her staff. And I think that was a real bellwether for the way that they're going to deal with folks in the media in this campaign.
Ed Kilgore, back to you. Tell us more about what you referred to as the strange dynamics of Iowa and what she faces when she gets there, where the caucuses will begin early next year, and then in New Hampshire, where she didn't do very well last time.
Well, she did pretty well in New Hampshire. She won. In Iowa, I think you could make a pretty good case that she, the central strategic error in her whole campaign was pouring so much money into an Iowa caucus competition that she couldn't win. And because Bill Clinton never had to compete in Iowa, I think that kind of fed the perception that she's got an Iowa problem. But again, there's nobody in the field, I think, that can really challenge her there unless she just concedes the state, which she clearly won't. So now it's just a matter of avoiding mistakes, laying out her campaign message, you know, giving people that have been anxious for a competitive caucus, you know, a little bit of love and affection, but at the same time, getting them used to the idea that she is already the Democratic nominee.
There were people who said, since she doesn't really seem to have any opposition in the Democratic Party at all, that she ought to forget Iowa because of the problems there and go on to win in New Hampshire, as you said, after all she did last time.
Well, I think that would possibly create a problem she doesn't presently have. Iowans really would flock to a Martin O'Malley or maybe even Jim Webb or Bernie Sanders if they're the only people there. And then she would have a problem. So I don't think she needs to obsess about Iowa. I don't think she has an inherent problem in the state, you know, but so I think she's probably going to handle it about right. But, you know, she's not going to spend all her money there the way she did in 2008, which turned out to be a real problem for her later on.
On the other hand, Jonathan Allen, she wouldn't want to lose Iowa, would she, particularly against candidates such as Martin O'Malley, the former governor of Maryland, or Jim Webb, who came from Virginia, or Bernie Sanders from Vermont?
I think she's highly unlikely to lose Iowa to any of those, I think, as Ed was suggesting. But yes, if she were to lose Iowa, that would be terrible for her and would open up the question, if not do more than open the question of whether she can be beaten.
So what do you think she'll be talking about, Jonathan Allen, in Iowa? And will she get around to these questions that are being asked by all kinds of people, including even the Economist magazine, which is, why does she want to run for president? What does she stand for?
Yeah, you know, I think she'll start to answer those questions, but I think her strategy here is to have policies created from, or at least appear to be created from, her discussions with voters. So while I'm sure she has her ideas, and in fact knows she has ideas for what policies she wants to pursue, I think she's not going to roll out those policies for quite some time. And I think when she does, she'll say things like, well, I was talking to Jim and Barbara in Des Moines, or, you know, Randy in Waterloo, and this is what he said he needed to do, and here's my way of addressing that.
Maybe she better be very careful about who she talks to.
She should probably be careful about who she talks to, because there are a lot of crazy policy ideas out there.
As Ed Kilgore said, the strange dynamics of Iowa. Ed, are they going to include people who would really like to see Elizabeth Warren in this race?
I think so. I think that, I think her meta message, and you see this right in the opening video, is something that ought to be familiar to people who watched her husband's campaigns. It's what I call safe change, that she wants to build on the accomplishments of the Obama administration, but very quickly and forcefully identify areas in which people are falling behind, need to catch up.
Okay.
And I, you know, that's sort of what her husband always stood for, was the ability to navigate, you know, radical changes in the global economy and technology in a way that brings everybody else along. So I think it's a very traditional Clinton message.
Ed Kilgore with the Democratic Strategist. We're going to be back with you and others. Jonathan Allen, thank you very much for being on our program. Again, chief political correspondent for Vox, author of HRC, State Secrets and the Rebirth of Hillary Clinton. On our talking point later, a dispute about personal belief exemptions from childhood vaccinations, pitting individual rights against public health. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
Well, we're only back with To the Point. We heard a little bit about Hillary from Hillary Clinton's web video of yesterday announcing her campaign for president in a very different way from the way she did it in 2007. Saturday Night Live did not lose any time. Here's their spoof.
I am running because I want to be a voice for women everywhere.
Did someone say women everywhere? Hillary would make a great president.
Thank you.
And I would make an even greater first dude.
Kate McKinnon and Daryl Hammond, in case you mistook those false voices for the real thing. Roger Hickey is co-director of the Campaign for America's Future. That's a progressive advocacy group. Roger Hickey, good to have you on our program.
Thank you, Warren. Good to be here.
How badly is that kind of thing going to hurt Hillary Clinton? She has been spoofed and spoofed and spoofed again.
Well, actually, Saturday Night Live made her video, which was quite impressive, her real video, look really good. And I must say that echoing Elizabeth Warren, who usually says the system is rigged for the rich and the giant corporations, Hillary says the deck is being stacked in favor of those at the top. That's a good way to start this campaign. Now, the real question is, you know, problems are going to arise when she tries to flesh this out and explain what she means by her new version of populism. And does she disagree in some cases with Bill Clinton, President Bill Clinton? My organization and three others are holding a conference here called Populism 2015 next weekend, well-timed. To ask some really basic questions of all politicians. Do they support continuing trade deals like NAFTA, which her husband negotiated?
Or the Pacific deal that President Obama is now negotiating and pushing.
Very similar to NAFTA. Will she break up the big banks that are too big to fail or deregulate the banks like her husband did? Does she favor increasing Social Security benefits, as 42 senators have recently voted for? These are big economic questions that she has clearly indicated she wants to take on. And we found out in the 2014 election that without a real clear message, Democrats don't do very well. The 2014 was a disaster. So she's made a good start. And a lot of activists in Iowa and New Hampshire or elsewhere are going to be asking her to be clear about where she stands compared to the other people already in the race and compared to Elizabeth Warren.
And as you said, compared to Bill Clinton, not to mention Barack Obama, whom she worked for as Secretary of State. You mentioned the trade deal. That certainly does involve foreign affairs, but big banks and Social Security don't. You didn't say anything at all about foreign policy.
Well, yes. I mean, I think that that President Obama is under siege right now in terms of his negotiations with Iran, and my guess is that she will come out in support, has already come out in support of the risks that he's taking to get a deal, and yet I think this is going to be a domestic policy election, unlike last time where I think her fatal mistake was not coming out against the Iraq war. I stood on a platform with her where she told a bunch of activists that she supported the Iraq war. And what that meant was that a whole lot of the activists were turned off and went to Barack Obama. So she needs to clarify what she means by an economic agenda. That's the key. And I have to say that she made a good start with this video, and yet she's going to be forced by people like Bernie Sanders and Governor O'Malley and Jim Webb to be much more clear about what she's going to run on.
She has said subsequently that she should not have voted in favor of the Iraq War, hasn't she?
She has, and I don't think that'll be a big issue this time around. But it's an example of the kind of fatal mistake you can make. If she doesn't criticize the banks right now, if she doesn't get clear about where she stands on Social Security and public investment in green jobs, that could turn off the not only the Democratic base who she wants to come out and vote for her, but these are issues that the average voter in both the primary campaigns and in the general election need to be clear about where she stands. The economy is still in trouble. The economy, as she indicated in her video, has been tough on average families, and she's got to elaborate an agenda for fixing that economy for working families.
Roger Hickey, again, co-director of the Campaign for America's Future, a progressive advocacy group. Kathy Obradovich is a political columnist at the Des Moines Register. Thank you so much for being on our program.
Thanks for having me.
What do people, particularly Democrats in Iowa, want to hear from her?
Well, I think that, first of all, they want to hear that she is sincere in wanting to run a campaign that puts voters first, that listens to their issues, and really focuses on the concerns of middle Americans and the fact, as she said in her video, that the deck is stacked against them.
So how does she show them that she is really sincere? Will be, you know, riding up in a van rather than flying in on a helicopter help to do that?
In a way. I mean, I think that this is a smart strategy for her to start with small, intimate gatherings. It plays well into the retail campaign tradition, not only in Iowa, but also in New Hampshire. And it also gives her an opportunity, I think, to start reestablishing herself in a campaign without the heavy pressure of having to, really define her whole message and her whole agenda in one big deal speech.
Let me ask the same question I asked in the first half of the program about these small, intimate gatherings in Iowa. It's pretty hard to get away from the massive press corps that's going to be following her around. What's going to be small and intimate about them?
Well, first of all, they're not going to let in the entire press corps that is following her around. It sounds to me like they're limiting pretty heavily the number of media that will be there. And yeah, I mean, as your other speaker said, it's not about the media that is sitting in the background. It's how she interacts with the people that are actually sitting at the table. I think that is part of the listening tour attitude that she's taking here, that she's here to hear what other people have to say and not just to give a speech.
Will there be a lot of people in Iowa who will be paying attention to Bernie Sanders, the independent senator from Vermont, and Jim Webb from Virginia, and Martin O'Malley from Maryland, if, in fact, they start campaigning there?
Well, they are campaigning here, and people have been coming to hear them. And, in fact, Bernie Sanders, for example, has really drawn big crowds from what I would consider to be the more progressive wing of the Democratic Party in Iowa, people who are concerned about the effect of Wall Street, people who are worried about climate change, people who may think Hillary Clinton has been too hawkish on military issues and foreign policy. And yes, they are these other candidates, potential candidates, are out there speaking to those issues. Does that mean that Hillary Clinton is in serious danger of losing the Iowa caucuses? I don't think so, not at this stage. She polls very well among Iowa Democrats. And, all of these other people who are coming to Iowa have serious challenges for a campaign. But I have to take issue with what some of your earlier speakers said. This is not about just stroking the egos of Iowa Democrats, or, Democrats are not just, they don't just want money to come from the Iowa caucus campaign. What they're worried about is really building the party and building a party organization that can win Iowa in November. Iowa is a swing state. We are being overrun right now by Republicans who are bringing their message to Iowa because they're running the caucuses as well. If Hillary Clinton leaves a void here, she really runs the risk of coming into an Iowa in the general election campaign where essentially people have just been immersed in Republican rhetoric for months and months and months. Iowa is a swing state. It's not something that it would be smart for her to leave it alone.
if she gets pushed to the left by Bernie Sanders, for example, might that hurt her later in Iowa when she has to run, presuming that she is the nominee, against a Republican?
Well, first of all, I don't know that she needs to be pushed by anybody else. Right now, she doesn't have anybody threatening her in the polls. You know, I do think that she is going to have to answer questions about where she stands on the issues of like people like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders have been raising. I think she does need to answer those questions, and I think she will. But I don't see her as being dragged to the left quite in the same way as perhaps whatever Republican emerges might be dragged to the right by the Iowa caucus process on the Republican side.
Let me go back to our earlier guest, Ed Kilgore, the managing editor at the Democratic Strategist, principal blogger at the Washington Monthly's Political Animal blog. What about the controversies of late that have dogged her, the emails that she used at the State Department, private ones instead of public ones, the contributions from very undemocratic states to the Clinton Foundation in very large amounts, the issues she's had to face as the Secretary of State with regard to the Benghazi and talking about leaving the White House dead broke so she could make millions on speaking fields. Is all that kind of stuff going to be brought up and used against her even in the primaries?
No, I doubt it in the primaries, though it'll be in the backdrop. First, let me hasten to correct the record a little bit. I didn't mean to give Kathy the impression that I thought that Hillary needed to stroke the egos of Iowans. All I was saying is that Iowa political campaigns are funded by competitive caucuses. This is what makes it possible for both parties in Iowa to have state-of-the-art campaigns. It's perfectly rational for them to want attention. It's not about their egos, but it is about money and resources. And I think once Hillary shows up there, I think that'll take care of her perceived problems. Getting back to the question you just asked about all these recent controversies, you know, I think I would put the email quote unquote scandal in a class by itself. The Benghazi thing is part of a broader assault on the Obama foreign policy that I don't think has any credence anywhere except among Republicans. The email scandal is a little bit different because it's so recent, and people don't quite know what to make of it. And I think it shocked some Democrats that somebody they thought of as the most thoroughly vetted politician in American history could have something we didn't know about. And I think that's what bugs a lot of Democrats and maybe even frightens them a little bit. But I think we're probably going to forget about this quote-unquote scandal in its obscure nature within the next few months. And I think ultimately Democrats will realize that, you know, it's always possible for something nobody can anticipate to blow up in the middle of a campaign. It's just a risk you run in politics. And then in the end, Hillary Clinton is the most thoroughly vetted politician in American history, and she's much better bet not to implode than anybody else you could think of.
Roger Hickey, let me go back to you, co-director of the Campaign for America's Future, the Progressive Advocacy Group. She has been thoroughly vetted. She is enormously familiar, of course, to everybody, one of the most famous people in the world. Are you worried that she might seem like old news?
Well, she's in this funny position where everybody knows her. But because she was Secretary of State and then unemployed, working on the foundation, she hasn't had to grapple with these economic issues that we've been talking about for quite some time. So she won't be dragged to the left, as somebody said. She will be clarifying her position. She will be clarifying her position about breaking up the big banks, fighting climate change, whether or not she opposes Fast Track and the TPP. She will be saying for the first time in a long time where she stands on these things. And my view is that if she stakes out some populist positions, it will add to the excitement not only in the primaries, but these are issues that average Americans, middle-class voters, middle-of-the-road voters care about in the context of an economy that's still not producing for the average family. As she says, the deck is stacked in favor of those at the top. She's saying that because she knows that that's the way most Americans feel about the economy.
Back to Kathy Obradovich, the political columnist at the Des Moines Register. So we've heard about climate change now. We also heard about Social Security. We heard about big banks. We heard about trade deals. Do you think that Iowa voters are going to be able to get her to firmly commit one way or the other on all of those extremely important issues where nobody really knows at the moment where she stands?
I think that if she does indeed campaign the way she says she's going to, which is to meet with people and answer their questions, she's absolutely going to hear questions about all of those issues. And it's going to be really glaring if she doesn't answer them. That's one thing that came up in 2008 was concerns about whether she was prepared to have audiences that were going to ask tough questions, or if she was going to just have hand-picked people and getting softballs from them. So I definitely think that if she runs the way she says she's going to, she's definitely going to have to face all those questions and answer them.
Roger Hickey, has she done a good job recently, for example, with regard to the amount of money that she was making on speeches? When she was asked about that on one of the television talk shows, she said, well, when we left the White House, we were dead broke. That didn't go over very well at all. Is there concern that she might not be prepared to answer these questions?
Well, she clearly has to answer these questions. That was a big mistake on her part, but it was not only a gaffe, it was in comparison with the big money she was taking in from speaking to bankers and other outfits, the money that the Clinton Foundation was taking in from foreign governments. She has to get past that, and she has to get past it in a way that focuses on the needs of average working people and doesn't avoids the feeling that she is simply coming in representing the big money wing of the Democratic Party. That's one of the big tensions in the party right now. She's got to raise money, but she's got to use it to say, I'm going to change the system, including the way that we finance campaigns in the future. So it's a challenge to her, and she's got to be ready to talk about a new form of democracy where we can get at these big economic issues without the banks and the other big funders buying the whole show.
Ed Kilgore, she's talking about raising $1 billion. Gary Hart, a one-time Democratic senator from Colorado, and of course a presidential candidate himself until he imploded, is saying that all Americans should be frightened at the idea that she's going to raise $1 billion. How does she do that and accomplish what Roger Hickey just suggested at the same time?
Everybody has to operate within the system as it exists. She can certainly advocate major changes in that system. But the reality is, in a general election anyway, what really matters in terms of money is having enough to be competitive. You don't have to beat the other side, but you can't just let them have, and Republicans are going to spend an ungodly amount in this election. We know it. You have to be competitive. I think a lot depends on where she gets her money. She could do a whole lot better this time than in 2008 in small dollar contributions that don't raise a lot of these concerns. Personally, if I were her, I would turn over all Super PAC fundraising to her husband. That's probably nobody is better than I've ever seen in a small room full of big egos at making people happy. And I think Bill Clinton might be better suited as a fundraiser rather than a spokesman at this campaign.
Roger Hickey, you're not thrilled about the idea of Bill Clinton being a part of this campaign particularly, are you?
Oh, he is very, very popular in the Democratic base.
But given his record that you laid out.
I just don't think it's a good idea to have him be the money man. They're very good at raising money from rich people. But if he becomes the face of shaking down the millionaires and the bankers to finance her campaign, that could be a big mistake. Yes, you have to raise money to be competitive, but I think the best way for them to handle that is to say, yeah, we're playing with the system we've got, but part of my campaign is to transform that system and get the big money out of politics so our democracy can work again.
Okay.
So we can make these kind of economic changes.
We're out of time. Roger Hickey, a Campaign for America's Future. Ed Kilgore, Democratic strategist. Kathy Obradovich, a political columnist at the Des Moines Register. Our earlier guest, Jonathan Allen at Vox. Many thanks to you all. Measles was declared eradicated in the United States 15 years ago, but a recent outbreak that began in Disneyland has sparked controversy over personal belief exemptions. We'll hear about individual rights and public health in a moment on To the Point.
KCRW's Eclectic 24 is our ever-expanding all-music stream, featuring the best new releases, classic favorites, and special features, including today's top tune, guest DJ project, and KCRW archives. Listen worldwide anytime online or through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out at kcrw.com/eclectic24.
Warren Olney back with today's talking point. As the recent measles outbreak was spreading in Southern California, it was reported that some of the stricken neighborhoods had low vaccination rates. That was traced to the state's liberal allowance of personal belief exemptions. Now, an effort to ban such exemptions has led to heated controversy, not just in Sacramento, but in other state capitals as well. Marcy Hamilton is author of God Versus the Gavel, The Perils of Extreme Religious Liberty. She's a professor at Benjamin Cardozo School of Law in New York. Marcy Hamilton, welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me.
What do the religious liberty have to do with the personal belief exemptions?
Well, it's interesting. Most of these exemptions started as a narrow religious exemption, but over time they evolved into philosophical exemptions, which made them huge. The bottom line is that the Constitution does not require either exemption.
The Constitution doesn't, but various state laws do.
Yes. A number of states have permitted these kinds of exemptions, although West Virginia and Mississippi have not, and they have the best health record for their children.
Mississippi and West Virginia?
I do understand that these are not states that are usually at the top of one's policy list on these issues, but neither of them has an exemption, and neither of them has had these serious outbreaks. Right now in Pennsylvania, we have an outbreak of pertussis in a Philadelphia suburban school district. That's a disease people probably haven't even heard of. They didn't know they were getting vaccinated for. But it has now reappeared just like measles and in some places mumps.
Mumps? What about polio?
Polio, not as much, but it's just that's another disease that's lurking in various corners. And if we lose the herd immunity that we had built up so successfully through these kinds of exemptions, we'll see that recur as well.
One of the people who has been adamant in favor of personal belief exemptions is Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the son of the former attorney general, presidential candidate. He has jumped into this debate. I don't think he's doing it for religious reasons. He believes, as do many, that the vaccinations, in fact, cause health problems.
Well, that is just in opposition to the vast majority of the medical science. When you have 90% and over of the medical community agreeing on the science, and what they say is that autism and other maladies are not linked to the vast majority of the vaccines, and in fact, vaccines have rare health consequences, it's just there's no debate. There's no real debate. There are people who are trying to gin up a debate, but you don't have a scientific debate when it's 90 to 95% to 0 to 5%.
There certainly is a political debate going on. There's one in California where one state senator is trying to have a law enacted that would prevent people from going to public schools if they weren't vaccinated. And in Oregon and Washington, laws of that kind, proposals of that kind, have been defeated.
Well, these proposals make a lot of sense. The question is, how much illness are we willing to tolerate when we can prevent it? And the science tells us that if we vaccinate everyone who can be vaccinated but for a medical problem, we're going to obliterate all of these diseases. But these kinds of exemptions open the door for disability and death of children and the elderly in particular, and then the vast unvaccinated in between. So we got off track. It's really time to remove, to return to where the science is. And as I say, there is a political debate, but that doesn't mean that's a debate about what's in the best interest of the public. And what's in the best interest of the public is now pretty clear.
So are you talking then about public rights, public health, for example, as opposed to individual rights?
That's right, but not as opposed to constitutional rights. The Constitution does not require these religious exemptions, certainly doesn't require the philosophical exemptions either. And so this is just at base a political debate. What is best for public policy, that we get as much vaccination as we can, or that we permit people to unilaterally decide whether or not they'll have their children vaccinated? And it's clear what the scientists are saying, and the top scientists like Paul Offit at CHOP in Philadelphia are saying, medical exemptions are a mistake. And so if a state does choose to have these kinds of exemptions, religious exemptions, philosophical exemptions, what they're choosing is illness for the people, and that's irrational.
You mentioned herd immunity. That is the concept whereby a certain percentage of the population has to be vaccinated in order for the total population to be saved or immune. And it's my understanding it's like 95%. If the medical situation is so clear, how did 48 states come to pass exemptions?
Well, unfortunately, in the Nixon administration, there was an increasing push for medical neglect exemptions, which permit parents not to provide medical care for their children if they're faith healers. On the heels of that has been this push to permit parents not to vaccinate their children. That stayed at a certain level, but then we had the increase in awareness of autism, the false links between vaccination and autism, and these exemptions exploded.
Okay.
So my view is we need to return back to common sense.
All right. Marcy Hamilton, again, a professor at the Benjamin Cardoza School of Law, author of God Versus the Gavel, The Parents of Extreme Religious Liberty. We're talking about much more than that. Thank you very much for being on our program today.
Thank you very much.
I'm Orman Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast, is a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.